Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everybody. So my name is Matthew Taylor, and I've hosted a few events in the tent, but this is the last one I'm hosting, and the one I'm most kind of proud of, because I'm hosting it with the organisation I run. So I run an organisation called the RSA. Has anyone ever heard of the RSA? Very good. So the RSA is an amazing organisation. It's 270 years old. It's partly a platform for ideas, just like this stage and this tent is for this weekend. So we're like this tent, but 50 weeks of the year, holding events and using our online footprint to get the best ideas in the world out to as many people as possible. We're partly a think tank, so we do lots of research, and the core of all our work is how is it we enable everybody to fulfill their potential. And we're partly a social movement, so we have 29,000 RSA fellows who have joined us because they share our values, and we support and empower them to be change makers in their community. So if you want to know more about the RSA, which is a truly amazing organisation, I've never done anything for more than 4 years before I went to the RSA. I've been there 12 years, and it's just every year it gets more exciting. So if you want to know more about the RSA, go to our amazing website, or there are various RSA people dotted around the room. So if you come up to me at the end, you can talk to someone about the RSA and about fellowship and how to get more involved. And here's somebody just waving. There's two RSA people. There they are, waving stuff. So you can come talk to them. So, as I say, the RSA holds two or three events every week, and they're all filmed, and this one's going to be filmed as well. You can watch them all online, but it's great to be there live. And today we're having an RSA event, not in our historic 250-year-old house, but here at Wilderness Festival. And it's an exciting event to be happening. So about a week ago I started preparing for this event, and I thought that the person I was going to be introducing to you was Afua Hirsch. That's who I thought I was going to be introducing you to, who is a barrister and a journalist and a campaigner and a writer. But then I read her book, and I'm not introducing you to Afua Hirsch, I'm introducing you to Efwa Hirsch, because one of the things that Efwa wants to say in her book, and does say in her book, about identity and the richness of identity and the challenge of identity and the politics of identity, is that it wasn't great growing up with a name that nobody could pronounce and nobody got right. So I hope I've done all right today, Efwa. So what's going to happen is Efwa's going to speak for about 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, and then I'm going to ask her two or three questions, and then we're going to open it up. And the issues that she's going to be exploring, we're going to be talking about, are some of the most heated, important, challenging, difficult questions of politics at the moment. So it's going to be a really interesting session. Please welcome Efwa Hirsch.
Matthew, thank you. I was just getting ready to tell Matthew off for mispronouncing my name after I knew he'd read my book, but he clearly read it carefully. The reason I write about how to pronounce my name in the book is that I actually grew up not able to pronounce my own name. This is one of the experiences I think some people realize we don't have when you are born into a culture that is different from the one that your parents grew up in, and you don't speak the language that your own name comes from. It's very difficult to correct people when they mispronounce your name when you can't actually say it correctly yourself. My book, Brit-ish, is about identity, race, and belonging. And the reasons that I decided to write this book are partly professional. I was a human rights barrister. I did a lot of criminal defense cases. I was the West Africa correspondent for the Guardian newspaper. I covered West Africa. And I was the social affairs and education editor for Sky News. So in my daily professional life, I was encountering people often on the margins of society. And I felt that identity was often at the core of their grievances. And that includes many white working class people who I interacted with, who expressed to me their frustrations at the struggles they faced in accessing housing and education and healthcare. And these grievances often manifested in a sense that the country was full, that there were too many immigrants, that multiculturalism had let them down. But when you unpicked their grievances, often at the root of it was a failure of government to provide services that were foreseeable. The primary goal of government being to provide with taxpayer money the needs for the people that I was interviewing. So this got me thinking about these narratives about immigration and belonging, the sense of entitlement, who is entitled to be British? And why do I, somebody who has lived in this country almost all my life, hesitate to call myself British? There isn't another country that I can call myself a member of, but yet this country, which is my country, I hesitate to own in my own sense of self. Part of the reason for that is what I call in my book, The Question. And the question is, and I capitalize it, it's not any question, it's the question. The question is, where are you from? The thing about the question is, it's often asked in a very well-intentioned way. I grew up in Wimbledon, which for anyone who doesn't know it, is a very leafy, pretty part of London. It's home to lawn tennis, strawberries and cream, long queues, all tennis whites. And it's a very English part of a multicultural city. Wimbledon is not diverse. Wimbledon is still overwhelmingly white and it still sticks to a lot of more rural English traditions. There are horses that go up and down my road and people playing lawn tennis. And in this town that I grew up in, almost every day of my life, I was asked by someone where I was from. And the thing about this question, as I said, is that it's not asked with malice. People who don't like you don't usually bother asking you where you're from. They just tell you to bugger off back there. So this is people who have a kind of curiosity, and there was no ill will intended with asking this question, but the effect of being asked this question so frequently in the place that I was from was that it began to make me think that I needed to provide an answer. And when I did try and say, well, I'm British, and they would say, yes, yes, but where are you really from? And I say, well, I'm from Wimbledon, yes, but where are you originally from? And eventually I realised that people wanted an explanation as to why I was brown. And you know, that's not a problem for me because I'm very proud of my heritage. My mother comes from Ghana. She was born in Ghana when it was still the Gold Coast, a British colony. My father's father was kinder transport from Nazi Germany in the war. And my paternal grandmother was a lady from Yorkshire who became a teacher in London when my grandparents met. So I can talk about my heritage and that's not a problem. The problem with the question is that I began to notice that it wasn't being asked equally of everyone around me. So I have many white English friends with fascinating family histories, Celtic heritage, Mediterranean ancestry, and they don't tend to get asked the question. And if they do, it's not the question, it's a question that's kind of asked further down a conversation. Whereas with me, I was finding people would ask me before they knew anything else about me to explain where I was from. And in my case, it began to make me think that I needed an answer. And I thought the answer must be Ghana because that's the reason that I looked different to everyone else around me. So I spent a lot of my childhood deciding that the solution to my identity problems would be to move to Ghana. And I remember very clearly the first time I went to Ghana when I was 15. And at this stage, I was very conscious of being the only black girl in my school, the person in Wimbledon that people asked where I was from. And of course, the moment I get off the plane in Ghana, they call me the white girl. At which point I realized that identity is not a question that can be solved by running to a place. Identity is a state of mind. I'll just tell you a little bit more about my family. So my paternal grandfather was born in Nazi Germany, as I said, to a Jewish family, and he fled to the UK under terrible circumstances, as so many Jewish refugees did. But he was able to assimilate into Englishness. He changed his name. His name was Hans. He changed it to John, like so many Jewish refugees did. He married an English woman. By the time my father was born, they lived in Sevenoaks, which is a very leafy part of Kent. And I have never in all my life heard anyone refer to my father or any of his siblings or any of their children as immigrants. They're British. I've never heard anyone ask about the contribution they've made to this country or the impact their immigration has had. My mother's family came from Ghana. My maternal grandfather worked for the colonial government in the Gold Coast, as it then was. And my family, my Ghanaian family, moved to London in the 1960s. And if anything, they were from a more affluent family than my Jewish family. They were very senior in Ghana when they lived there. They came here. My mother and her siblings went to private schools. But to this day, my Ghanaian family are regarded as immigrants. My grandmother has faced racist abuse well into her 80s. And my mother and all her siblings, who are professionals, all of them, still are counted as immigrants, asked where they are from, and seen as something that is problematic. And I think as a child, children aren't born looking for race or racialized identities. As I write in my book, I didn't look for race. Race found me. It found me in the question, in the ways people treated me differently, and in the often subtle and sometimes well-intentioned things that people would say to me. And I'll give you an example. In my school, my school friends, who are all white, once said to me, I remember very well, as we were sitting under a tree, one of them putting her hand on my shoulder and saying, "Don't worry, Af, we don't even see you as black. You're fine." And I remember that because at the time, I knew there was something wrong with it, but I couldn't articulate what it was. And I don't think my friend who said it could have articulated what was wrong with it either. But as I've become more versed in the questions of race and social justice, I've realized that she had internalized the idea that there was something bad about being black. And the best thing she could do for me was to try and pretend that that baggage, that toxic baggage, didn't apply to me, that she could exempt me from blackness and that would be giving me a step up. And as somebody who was proud of my Ghanaian heritage, that was a very painful message. And as I've become older and become a parent myself, I've seen that messaging continue. And people like me don't face what a generation before us faced, which was an often existential violent struggle every day because of the color of their skin. I never got beaten up in the street or yelled rude words because of my race. Instead, it was people saying these often well-intentioned things like, "Where are you from?" or "Don't worry, we don't even see you as black, you're fine." I feel that the questions of race and identity have been made more subtle and more covert, and the narratives that underpin them, which fundamentally to me come from our history as an imperial country that's never really dealt with its past, never really dealt with the fact that for centuries we had a whole global system based on the idea that the English race was superior to all others in the world. We've never fully confronted that, and many of the ghosts lurk in our everyday language, in the way that we see things. Just think about one word, which I'll leave you with, which is the main word we use for multiculturalism when we want to talk about it in a positive sense. We speak about tolerance. We talk of ourselves as a tolerant country. When you really think about that word, what does it say? It says that people who have different heritage are a problem, but it's a problem we're willing to tolerate. I don't think we think enough about this language or the ideas that underpin it or the history that created it. And my book, I'm calling for us to have that conversation. My book is not a blame-calling book. It's not accusing people of racism. It's trying to get away from the idea that racism is a personal way of looking at the world, that racism is a person who is prejudiced, who doesn't like other people. Those people exist, but they're a small minority. Race is a system. It's the structural pattern of allocating privilege and resources that we are all affected by. And I want us to start thinking much more deeply about those patterns and how they affect different parts of our society equally. Because I believe that if we truly want to live in a post-racial society, we can't leapfrog to it without doing the difficult work. And it is difficult sometimes to talk about these things. That's why I went into issues as personal and sensitive as how to say my own name, because I believe that if I'm going to encourage people to have difficult conversations, I need to do the same. Thank you.
So if you don't mind, we'll just carry on walking around the stage.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
If you sit down, you just have your back to people.
So okay, that's fine.
Is that right with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
It might seem like I'm sometimes following you and you're following me.
I just feel bad for these lovely people who brought us chairs.
Let's just walk around. Yeah, great. Okay, so your book has got a strong kind of autobiographical element to it, but in some ways it kind of felt... I had a kind of personal historic engagement with it as well, because you kind of go through the ways in which we've tried to get this right. You know, kind of people like me who consider themselves to be right on. So you talk about the early attempts to kind of address issues around race and ethnicity were around integration around a kind of cohesive British idea. You know, that's your tolerance notion. You know, you can be one of us as long as you accept the way things are, yeah? And then we move into kind of multiculturalism, and then that's the kind of big moment. And now multiculturalism is critiqued because it's seen as being tokenistic and being divisive, and also to an extent not recognizing that whiteness is a culture in itself. And then we kind of move into this new era, which is a notion that we're back to the idea of a single identity, but now it's a diverse and inclusive identity. And so, although we are going to count, so we're going to do this B-A-M-E thing, which you don't like either. So as long as the ratios are right, the identity issue is kind of solved, apart from maybe some Muslims who seem very angry about stuff. So that's our current kind of position. Basically, you just think we've got it wrong every single time, don't you? So I want to know, why do we keep getting it wrong, and how on earth do we get it right?
I think it's, for me, quite easy to explain why we got it wrong, which is, as I said, we haven't been doing the difficult work. We've been taking the easy solutions. So I'll just pick up on BAME, as you mentioned. You know, B-A-M-E. You'll hear it in government, in the corporate world, black and minority ethnic. It's kind of the accepted bureaucratic term for people who look like me. And I have a number of problems with it, but I'll just give you an anecdote which kind of summarizes them all, which is, since writing my book and I've been having these conversations, people have been saying things to me like, as a BAME woman, what do you think? You know, BAME is not an identity. I don't get up in the morning, look in the mirror and see a BAME person staring up at me. What is that? Another one, even worse in my mind, was when I was having a meeting with a production company the other day, and they said to me, you know, you tick every box. You're a woman, you're diverse. I'm not diverse. Diversity is not an identity. And, you know, for me, it's no surprise that we started to abuse this language because we have papered it on top of cracks that we've never properly analysed. So, again, it often is well-meaning. But I don't think we've done the work. Just to kind of go a bit deeper into my... I think, you know, you mentioned the fact that multiculturalism ignored whiteness. I often think of multiculturalism through the three S's, saris, steel bands, and samosas. You know, it's this idea that the kind of multicultural elements of society, this kind of like homogenized brown lump that exist in their separate communities. And I still have no idea what the black community is, you know, because my family's from Ghana and they have some pretty retrograde ideas about people from the West Indies, if you go back a couple of generations. And same with, you know, you talk to a first-generation Windrush person, they wouldn't necessarily consider themselves from the same community as a Ghanaian or a Nigerian or a Somali person. But I think that we have this sense of these people, whiteness being the norm, and these people being other, and us being willing to tolerate their otherness within the white normality. And when I see the way this has played out over time, you know, I was 16 doing my A-levels when Tony Blair was voted in and New Labour, and I, like everyone else I knew, felt this rush of euphoria that we'd kind of, multiculturalism would triumph now and tolerance would win, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Now when I see the gains that we've made in diversity, I see black, Asian, people from minority heritage in positions of power and influence, not as many as there should be, but they're there. They are not able to be authentic to the perspective and experience they've had. Too often, they feel pressured to conform to the existing cultural norm. And that totally undermines the entire point of diversity. And the reason is we never challenge that cultural norm. We never challenge the idea of whiteness as the desirable, successful marker that others can gain acceptance by the closer they get to it. And one of the things I find most inspiring now is that I feel that a new generation is challenging that. If you look at some of the other books that have come out, most recently Slay in Your Lane by these two young black girls from working class backgrounds who talk about going to university and refusing to conform. And the way that their behavior was policed, not only by their white peers, but by their black peers, who felt very threatened by the idea of these girls living their blackness as they interpret it as a culture. So I think that we have a lot of work to do to go deeper. We've just taken a superficial approach to what diversity is, to what multiculturalism is. We've adopted a few new terms, felt that if you put a black person on the front of every brochure and make sure that there's one in all of the right pictures, job done.
So, FYI, yeah.
Thank you.
So I want you to know, when I read the book, there were moments when a kind of 57-year-old white man like me might have got defensive. I didn't, you know, but I've noticed moments when someone like me might have thought of kind of rather shallow, superficial response. I'm just going to share those with you.
Okay, please.
I'm just going to imagine I was somebody who had these kind of reactions at certain points. So I wonder, there's two things in particular, if it's not self-indulgent. The one is, you just said, I'm not diverse. Now, there's a bit in the book, I think you talk about the fact that you feel not knowing about your great-grandmother, is it like a big thing for you? And it feels like it's personal. And it's a loss for you that you have to find out. I have no idea who my great grandmother was. You know, I don't really think that she was probably anyone particularly kind of interesting, because I don't find my own, how can I say, I don't find my own identity interesting. So I guess the point I want to make is the flip side of the challenges you talk about in your book is an incredible richness. Is the fact of, you know, being Jewish and being Ghanaian and being British and having all of that stuff, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's great. My book's not, it's not a complaint. It's not, and people often assume this, and I know you haven't, but people often assume that I'm kind of assuming this victim status. And it's not that, you know, I have an incredibly rich heritage that I'm endlessly fascinated by. So do so many other people. Actually, it's fascinated me, the response to my book, because I've gone to events where there's not a single person of colour in the audience, and people who I would have probably, and we all have our own ignorance, I would have presumed had more straightforward white British identities, have come up to me in tears and said, you know, my grandmother was Irish and I've never felt the same as other British people, and this is a huge part of who I am, and I totally relate to what you're saying. So I think it's more a more widespread and complex issue than even I would have understood when writing the book. My issue with my great-grandmother was a bit different, because I grew up in Wimbledon, as I said, and I had a sense, and I think this prevails, that I live in Britain, which is the country of, you know, Brunel and Newton and great scientific and cultural endeavour, and that my Ghanaian family come from this other place, you know, which is kind of over there. And I don't think this, but a lot of people think it's kind of this village, you know, with a few bongos and a few mud huts. And I grew up right by Wimbledon Common, and there's this beautiful windmill that I used to play around, and there's a plaque on the windmill that says Robert Baden-Powell wrote Scouting in that windmill. And when I was researching up my book, I found out by accident that Baden-Powell led an assault on the Ashanti Kingdom in the late 19th century as a senior military officer under the empire, and that war displaced my actual great-great-grandmother and turned her into a refugee so that she fled to the village where my family now live. And so his role in empire is so directly relevant to my own heritage, yet even though I lived right underneath it, I had no idea of the connection. I thought that Africa was over there and Britain is over here. And I thought, if that exists on my doorstep, what else in the environment around me has those links and those connections buried underneath it, and we just walk past not knowing? And that's because that history has been erased. And I think we all lose a huge part of our story because we hide and ignore and downplay and shy away from those stories.
So that takes me to the second thing that I felt when I was reading the book, that could lead people to kind of feel defensive, which would be, you know, I completely understand intellectually the argument for us needing to understand our history, and particularly our history of colonialism and our involvement in slavery. And then, you know, as you make the point, when you talk about slavery, everyone wants to celebrate William Wilberforce, but they don't want to talk about what happened for the 250 years before that. But I guess I want to say politically, a political strategy that is about British people feeling worse about their history sounds like a difficult political strategy. It's a difficult thing to encourage people to do in order to become more aware.
I've got a way of selling it to you.
Okay.
So, it's true. We love a good celebration, right? We talk about abolition. We don't talk about the slave trade that we helped create that needed to be abolished. We love the Commonwealth, get all the flags out. We don't talk about the slightly awkward issue of the empire that it's a direct descendant of. If you ask me what my idea about British values is, and Matthew, I hope you might back me up on this, right up there in my league table of British values, I would put intellectual curiosity and an interest in history. You know, and think about the second one. We all go to National Trust properties. We love period dramas. We read our great historic novels. We're obsessed with history. We have 50 TV documentaries about the Second World War every year in Britain. 50. As a country that cares about intellectual integrity and history, I think it is a British value to engage in an objective and fact-based approach to our past. And when I see the kind of propaganda that we promote with reference to the empire and the slave trade, it reminds me more of what I'd expect of a former Soviet bloc than Britain. And I think there is a huge hypocrisy there. I think we pride ourselves on people who don't engage in that kind of simplistic propaganda. Yet when it comes to these issues, we just have not been able to cope. And I think the Second World War is a big part of that. Obviously, I wasn't alive when it happened. But the more I've looked into this, the more I've realised that our sense of moral victory after the Second World War, our sense of having been on the right side of history, is so strong and justified. But the flip side of it is that we've not been willing to engage with anything that is counter to that narrative of victorious glory. And it's dumbed us down. It's made us very fragile. And that is, you know, and just to kind of leap forward to Brexit, you know, when I see what's going on in Britain now, I see that fragility. And I think that there are real consequences if you don't engage in the difficult work. You set yourselves up as a country whose identity is dependent on upholding a set of myths. Anything that provokes the truth beneath those myths makes people hysterical. And that's exactly what is happening today, in my opinion.
So last question for me. And and then we'll take a few points and questions from the room, because I'm sure you've provoked a lot of interesting responses. But there are a couple of points in your book where you indicate a certain squeamishness about certain ways in which identity politics is played out, pulling down of statues. You're not sure about whether that's a particularly worthwhile thing to do. But yet, identity politics has become incredibly freighted. I mean, it's, you know, I do a program called The Moral Maze. If, you know,
yes. I've been on it with you.
Yeah, you have. And the people on that program are obsessed with the idea that identity politics is tearing Britain apart. And we have the whole concept of the snowflake and all of that kind of stuff. But your text is a key text in identity politics. So tell us how to sort out what is good identity politics and what is identity politics that is self-indulgent or an attempt by people to co-opt meaning into their lives in a way that isn't particularly kind of constructive.
The problem with the identity politics narrative is that there's a sense that there are kind of sensible people who don't engage in identity, and then there's people like me who talk about identity. We all have identities. As I said earlier, one of the issues, I think, is that we don't understand whiteness at all. So we don't recognise that whiteness is a strong cultural identity in this country. And we are seeing a global climate in which cultural candidates are winning elections because they overtly promote whiteness. It's often not phrased like that, but you just have to look at Trump. The messaging around him, you know, for someone like me, not in any way to celebrate his presence or, you know, ongoing power, but it makes it so much easier to show people how powerful these narratives around cultural identity and whiteness are. And the critics of identity politics enjoy the privilege that comes with their whiteness, and they enjoy the luxury of saying, I don't have an identity, but all of you do, and you need to take it out of politics. So I would like us all to be more honest. Identity informs all of our politics, but my work on identity is not in the spirit of divisiveness. I think I actually have a more optimistic relationship with Britain than, say, your opposites on the moral maze, because I genuinely believe that if we do this work, we could be a country that can thrive in a globalised world where we have a population that looks as our population does. But I think that without doing that work, there is no way we can compete in our global reality. And what really makes me upset about our political leadership, and I do feel we have a crisis of political leadership, I don't see anyone brave enough to be honest about some of these questions. And I think that that is letting all of us down.
Great. Okay, so we're ending on, F was ended there on honest questions. So let's have honest questions and points, and we'll start with the gentleman here in the front row.
Hi there, thank you for your talk. I want to interrogate...
Tell us your name. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, my name's Shanko. I am the child of Indian immigrants. I wanted to interrogate the question, the use of the word we, when you say we need to do so-and-so. And I want to know whether you agree with the idea that the emotional burden is placed disproportionately on people of colour in 100%. This action of we. And when we say we, and we actually use the word we need to kind of shield white fragility. Mm. And if you do agree with that, what do you think are the best mechanisms for readdressing that balance?
Thank you. I completely agree, and it's a great question. I think that one of our problems, and there's a parallel with gender, you know, I think there's still this kind of underlying assumption that feminism is an issue for women. And there's also an underlying assumption that these questions of identity and equality and social justice are questions for people of colour. We have to solve them. They're not our burden to carry. Every single person who lives in this society, if they care about a society where opportunity is distributed equally, these are all of our problems. And that's, I think, why I come back to whiteness, because I think that whiteness does act as a shield that makes people think, I don't have any identity issues, and, you know, this race stuff is for them. And they're obsessed with it, you know. I mean, David Goodhart, when he reviewed my book, called me the high priestess of the cult of racism, which was actually quite flattering, I thought. And said I was single-handedly promoting racial division in Britain, which, I mean, who knew I was so powerful? But I think that you're completely right. And when I say we, I mean we as British people, as anyone invested in this society who considers themselves an active participant in our future, has a responsibility to engage with these questions. And I don't shy away from myself, but I completely agree. I don't support anything that promotes the idea that it's my work or your work or something, a problem for us to solve. And that's why, and let's face it, if you look around at this festival's not representative of the demographics of the part of the country we're in, right? It disproportionately attracts a certain kind of person. That's because of class, as well as cultural and historic issues. But the reason that I enjoy speaking to audiences like this is because I know that people come because they want to engage, and that's really important. And so I thank you all for coming.
Right, so what I'm going to do, because I've seen lots of hands running out of time, I'm going to take three or four comments together, and then if you don't mind answering together, and then we'll have to wrap up. So could you pass the microphone back to the guy behind you?
Sure.
Very good.
Thank you very much. My name's Dominic. I actually grew up down the road from yourself, or your family in Tunbridge Wells, so the story rang true to me because I was the only brown person for like a 20-mile radius. And now I'm in my 30s, I go to meetings to go and see clients, and the majority are white males. The response when I go to meet them is normally, Dominic? Because on the phone, I don't sound like the way that they think I'm going to look. So my question is, the term unconscious bias is something I keep hearing bandied around, and at what point do you think in society when we'll get past that point of the unconscious bias?
Okay, try and remember that one. Okay. Pass the Thank mic you. Back.
Hello.
Back. Back. There, great.
Hello.
My name is Petra. I've got two questions, two quick ones.
Okay.
One about colorism and the other one about being the only one. Did you feel as though you had to be a bit of an ambassador in that potentially you were the first person that someone would have met of colour? So did you feel that pressure? Because, again, like that gentleman, perhaps the gentleman over there, it kind of rang true to me, and I kind of felt that pressure, if you like. So.
Thank you very much.
And then final one.
Hello.
My
name's Saba, which is pronounced exactly as I've just said it. I learnt that quite a while ago. My question is, at what point do you correct people when they mispronounce your name several times? And do you just go through life accepting that people say your name wrong? When is it rude to tell them, have you met somebody that has called you by the wrong name for years? And at what point do you just say, actually, that's not how you pronounce it? Yeah.
Thank you.
Finally.
Oh, yeah. Okay, hello. Thank you.
Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Is positive discrimination a positive or patronising?
A good question. Thank you so much. All right, I'm going to come to Saba first because it's in my head. In my book, I give some examples, actually, of other people of Ghanaian heritage who are public figures with mispronounced names. So Kwasi Kwarteng, it's meant to be Kwesi. Paul Boateng, meant to be Boateng. And I feel that we kind of internalize the mispronunciation. And one of the really interesting things about my book, and that was actually the hardest part of my book to write, weirdly, because I knew that people close to me might feel hurt. And I did, when the book came out, get all of these old friends going, oh, you never told me all these years. So I, at a young age, kind of like, you pick your battles, right? I think when I was 7, I tried to change my name to Caroline. And my parents wouldn't have it. And I thank them for that now. But I feel sorry for my younger self because I was just trying to find a way through. So you do pick your battles. But now I've got more confidence to kind of
explain to people. And also, people don't want to mispronounce someone's name, right? So it's not... it can just be draining, really. So you pick your battles. And there are so many of these things, aren't there? You kind of choose which ones to come back on and which ones you've got to get through a day. Thank you so much for the question. Positive discrimination. Where's the gentleman who asked it? So, yeah, hello. Thank you for that. I personally believe that we have such an uneven playing field that if you don't do something to address it, you won't get equality. You know, it's one of the things I find fascinating that we all remember the murder of Stephen Lawrence, the horrific murder of Stephen Lawrence, and the McPherson report that came out after his death. And the thing we remember from it is that the police, the Met police, had institutional racism. It's actually more interesting on these questions. And what McPherson said was that if you treat everyone the same, it does not create equality because you have such entrenched historic inequalities in the opportunities and prejudice towards certain groups that if you don't do something radical, you can just perpetuate the same inequality. So I'm not saying positive discrimination is the only way, but I do think that the idea that, oh, well, we're not racist anymore and we treat everyone the same, that's not enough. That doesn't level out a playing field that is so skewed for so many centuries. Thank you. Okay, Petra, hello. And now I've gotten your question.
Colorism.
Oh yeah, being an ambassador. So I do a lot of TV debate shows and people often ask me how I cope with some of the ignorance that I have to deal with. But that's not the hard thing. When I do these live TV debates, I'm usually the only person of color and often the only person remotely on the left as well. The thing that I find really stressful is I feel like I am speaking for basically everyone who either looks like me or shares my politics, and that if I don't do justice to their argument, I've let everyone down, and that burden is so hard to carry. And when I was doing research in my book, my cousin and I unearthed my grandfather's letter. So my grandfather got a colonial scholarship to Cambridge in 1944 from Ghana. He was the son of illiterate farmers, so it was a huge deal. And every year the colonial authorities sent the brightest African students to Oxbridge so they could go back and run the colonies for them. And my grandfather didn't do as well as he wanted in some exams at the end of a year. And he wrote to his master, "I hope that one day some other African students will come and redeem the good name of Africa at this university." And that made me so emotional because I thought this young man who had never lived in this country or this climate or this environment before, in addition to all that he was struggling with to acclimatize, also had this idea that if he did not get a first every time, he was ruining it for his entire race. I mean, what a weight to carry. And ironically, I still related to that, which gave me a sense of how things haven't changed as well as how they have. Colorism, I think it's a really important conversation to have. And I always feel it's important to acknowledge my privilege, both my class privilege, because I grew up in a very middle-class home and I went to private school. And that's been very triggering for some people who seem to think that if you're like me, you don't have any right to critique Britain. But that's a whole other conversation about privilege and race. I think the idea is that you're only allowed to be privileged if you're white, but if you're like me, I should be very grateful that I was allowed to get into any elite institutions. So yes, I think it's really important. If you look at the people of colour who are promoted in the media, they often are lighter complexion, they have more European features, and it's highly noticeable. So I think that is a really important conversation to have. I think often it's a conversation that people of colour need to have among themselves. But I do a lot of advocacy in terms of representation in the media. And I think, again, this idea that you just tick a box, you've got a brown person, it doesn't matter whether they're of South Asian heritage or they're mixed race or they're African, as long as they are a bit brown, you're fine. And it's so simplistic. Thank you very much for the question. Dominic, oh my God, I relate. Sometimes when people meet my mother, they do like a triple take, like, what? Because they just, having spoken to her on the phone, are so convinced she's white. Because my mother speaks English like I think only people born in the empire speak. Like, British people don't speak that way anymore. It's very Edwardian. And when they meet her, she's a dark-skinned woman of African heritage, and they just can't reconcile it. So I think, again, you know, we have these really simplistic ideas, right? Black people are urban, i.e. we spontaneously combust if we leave the M25, right? We belong in the inner city. And we live in single-parent homes that are very poor and underprivileged. And there, you know, disproportionately, people of African heritage do live in disadvantaged homes. But we've become so unsophisticated in our understanding, similar to the way we think about BAME, that it's this idea that, you can't be privileged and be black. Or, and this comes from people of all races, I've had black people tell me, you're not a proper black person. What kind of black person goes to Oxford? You know, and that we've kind of so internalized these ideas about poverty and disadvantage that we think that if you're a real black person, you can't be well educated. And that is sad, but you can see where it comes from. So I think that it's for us to change that in a way that acknowledges that this disadvantage exists and it is intergenerational and it comes from a place in our history, but that there are people of colour who aren't disadvantaged and that the two coexist and it's not that complicated. Thank you.
So I was actually being slightly ironic earlier on when I talked about somebody like me having reactions like, but my identity is so boring, or do I have to feel bad about my country's history in order to be right on? Those are some of the reactions I went through reading the book, because the book is a very powerful book. It's a very challenging book. I would encourage you all to read it. It's a very rich book as well. F was going to be in the bookshop signing the book immediately after we've finished. If you want to hear more talks as interesting, conversations as exciting as this, then the RSA is your place. Go and look at the website or say hello to some of our RSA people and they're going to stand up again. Here they are now if you want to know more about the RSA. But it just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Ephra Hirsch.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.